Hello, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. I'm John Atack, and I have, as Joe has pointed out to me, a frog in my throat. So I'm going to see if I can do slightly less talking than usual, which will be a first. And I am delighted to welcome my dear friend and colleague, Joe Zimhart. Hi, Joe.
Hello, John, and sorry to hear about your throat condition, but we'll just put up with it. How's that?
Yeah, frogs have rights too.
That's right. They and you know we are in a frog pond of cult experts, so let's croak away.
It's true, a small pond, big frogs in a
Oh
small pond.
yeah.
Grand. So you have brought us a fascinating subject to us, and go ahead and introduce it.
Right, so this all started with my appearance recently in Pittsburgh with a Canadian film crew. This film crew is doing a documentary based on this book, Monkey on a Stick. And the subtitle is Murder, Madness, and the Hare Krishnas. So it's based on a period of time in the Hare Krishna movement, or ISKCON, International Society for Krishna Consciousness, that was brought here by Swami Bhaktivedanta, or Prabhupada, in 1966. And of course, he was the one of the first wave of ersatz gurus from Asian countries to appear on Western shores in the US, especially after Lyndon Johnson lifted the Asian Exclusion Act, which is in place from 1921 until 1965. And
Wow.
suddenly we had the perfect storm of a flood of Zen masters and Hindu gurus and Indonesian shamans and all of this stuff planting themselves on American shores and making a lot of money. And also all of the thousands of, people, seeker hippie types and intellectuals and people that were uncertain about their identity and what life was all about, glomming on to Divine Light Mission, the ISKCON group,
Transcendental meditation.
Sri Chinmoy, and it was constant. Well, along with that came the early Jesus movements, because that became a thing. In the late 60s, there were quite a few of them that started to arise. And again, young hippies wanting to get off drugs went into a lot of these places. And Jim Jones, of course, with People's Temple, was like that. He was one of the early Jesus movements, that attracted some white people, mostly black people, because of his target audience. Along with that, what came a lot of other power movements, besides hippie power and LSD power. There was black power, the black movement, and there was Indian red power. The native indigenous rights, were a thing that came up, consistently. So while I was there in Pittsburgh talking to this Canadian crew, we got talking about Buffy St. Marie, who became a folk music icon in the 60s early on, and made a big splash as not only an interesting folk musician, but a Native American folk musician that she claimed she had. Her blood roots were with some tribe, and especially in Canada. And then she began to identify as Cree, as part of the Cree Nation. So she got quite famous. She was on, as a Native American guest on Sesame Street for some years. She won numerous awards that were for Native American artists in Canada and other places. And she took these awards as a Native American folk singer or whatever. Now, she did a lot of work promoting Native rights, and she was in the forefront, and they accepted her as one of them. She did songs with "Hey, hey, hey, hey," that kind of thing, singing, and recorded these, and they were accepted by the Native American as well as, the people that sympathize with Native Americans as part of the whole milieu. Well, it turns out in the last year or so, there was a researcher, a woman who has Native American rights or blood, a professor, began looking into her background because it sounded like what's called pretendians, people pretending to be Indian. You know, she fit that narrative, and she got curious about it. Like, for instance, this Miss Littlefeather that accepted the Oscar for Marlon Brando decades ago, and Brando refused to show up because he was protesting the Oscars and their misuse of, you know, they didn't respect native rights and all that kind of thing. And so she appeared with dressed kind of like an Indian, you know, with to accept the Oscar for whatever. And it turns out that she's a pretendian. She wasn't a Native American either. And
there's that famous advertisement with the chief in a headdress crying by the side of the road. Yeah.
That's another one.
In the early 70s, isn't he? And he wasn't a Native American either.
That's a pretendian too. Oh. Now, you know, when I was a kid, we had a show here in Philadelphia called Chief Halftown. And he would appear to do this variety show for children. He was very good, but it was back in the Sally Star days and the days when there was black and white TV in the 50s. Mm. But Chief Halftown was a full-blooded Indian. He was real, you know, and he wore the bonnet and all this stuff. But he's actually a real Native American, much like the gentleman that played Tonto in The Lone Ranger. He wasn't a real Native American. Mm. You know, he wasn't fake.
But Will Rogers in the 30s, you know, who never met a man he didn't like. He'd obviously had a very sheltered life, but who was genuine, Cherokee.
He had a lot of Cherokee in him. And there was Jim Thorpe, of course, who was a genuine Native American. Mm. He was a famous athlete.
And Cher, as in Sonny and Cher.
She had some Native,
So, but she was part Armenian as well or something exotic.
Right. Yeah. Most of the people with indigenous blood are mixed these days, you know, much like black people are.
And white people when we get down to it.
And white people too, you know. I'm supposedly pure Hungarian. All my ancestors were Hungarian speakers and in Hungary, except for maybe one from Austria, but that was a Hungarian speaker as well. But when I look at my DNA, I may be 36% Eastern European, which could be Hungarian, you know, and there's German and stuff in there. Even the Hungarian people aren't pure Hungarian because they are a mix of Slav and Turkic and Hungarian and other sources, you know, that blended together. So, you know, being a pure Hungarian is hard to argue. There isn't any, but there are Hungarian speakers. So anyway, getting back to Buffy St. Marie, you know, this really intrigued me because she represents almost like a lot of the profile of a lot of cult leaders that we have that become pretend shamans or pretend people that have come from another planet and embodied here on Earth. And, you know, we have these stories and there's millions of people that accept these things. Mm-hmm. Because of their personal experience with the person. It sounds true, it feels true, and therefore it's got to be true because I think it's true. You know, that's the narrative.
Yeah, and, feelings of certainty that William James talked about.
Feelings of certainty.
So
and also what your friend talks about awe, being awed by the person.
Yuval Law,
Yeah, and so that happened with Buffy St. Marie. It was kind of awesome that she was not only a good, proficient folk singer in that whole scene, and she was attractive, and she was, you know, quite a good performer, but she was also Native American, which put a whole gloss on her that was very unique, you know, and she ran with it, obviously. Mm. And she still resists the fact that it's been exposed, that she's Italian, grew up in Massachusetts. There's video of her and her family done by a cousin, you know, and she has a brother and a sister that are Italian, and why wouldn't she be Italian? Mm. So she claimed that maybe she was adopted by her family, and real fuzzy story that she came from an indigenous tribe. And so this is still going on. She's resisting coming clean, apparently.
Mm. Which is also classic, that if we look at Ron Hubbard and his claims to be a war hero, to have studied with gurus in the East, to be a nuclear physicist, he would hotly contest anybody that said he was not a blood brother of the Pikuni people, even though the Pikuni never, in fact, I don't think any Native Americans ever had blood brothers. I think it's a Viking myth that came in through Hollywood in the 20s and 30s. But
yeah, that's probably very true.
They protest too much. They protest very loudly if challenged. I mean, the other one that springs to mind is Grey Owl. And there's a lovely film with Pierce Brosnan in it, it's Grey Owl, which I definitely recommend. I'm not going to spoil it, but he's a pretendian. You know, what can we say? Oh, I spoiled it.
Uh-oh. Oh, well. We can always edit that out if you wish. Yeah. I wouldn't. Yeah. Yeah, so getting back to Monkey on a Stick, you know, here we have also a legitimate Hindu coming over representing the culture, and we would argue he misrepresented a lot of the Hindu culture with his, you know, translations of the Bhagavad Gita, which, you know, most scholars think of bad translation, not a good translation.
It's interminable, the Bhagavad Gita as it is. I mean, the text's about that much, and this is a book about this much. Again, it's like a Hubbard book. It just endlessly unpacks.
Right. Well,
I will put in a little experience here. When I was about 18, I used to go and stay with a friend who used to go to the Krishna temple at Watford. And on a Sunday, he would get up and he'd get his girlfriend up and what have you. And they'd put a little shrine up and they'd do readings from the Bhagavad Gita as it is. And I remember him stopping his girlfriend and going, "No, June, that's not how you pronounce the Sanskrit properly." You know.
Oh, interesting.
He never had the little haircut, though, in the end. The celibacy.
You got to get it right. So anyway, we have this guy, this fundamentalist Hindu, basically fundamentalist. He was very misogynistic, you know, and ran the whole caste system into the U.S. with women have to be subservient and all that nonsense. And he disdained children being around. He wasn't great with them because they put them in these gurukulas where they were abused, you know, he really wanted fundraisers, people out there doing what he called Sankirtan, which was basically fundraising. It wasn't what Sankirtan really means, which is celebration.
Spiritual sky justics. And there's a record of Govinda being sung. Yeah.
So then we have all of these white and some black folks, you know, becoming pretendians in the sense of pretend Indian Hindus, you know, in a way, and dancing around and wearing the saris and the sikas and the, you know, the markings and all of this, you know, when in fact they weren't born into the culture. Now, it's not unusual for someone to take on another culture and become legitimately, you know, like a Shinto person that may have been born in South America or whatever. I mean, become a Hindu, for instance, accepted within the Goswami order, like Agadananda Bharati was, the author of the Yoga Robe. He was a legitimate Swami that learned Sanskrit, that studied under the Goswami order, and was ordained and became a Swami and taught on foot in the indigenous Hindu languages. He could speak four of them from village to village for years before he became a college professor of religious studies, you know, and he could have taken on students, be a guru. But whenever one approached him, because he had some students, he would say, "You have to study Sanskrit for 3 years, become proficient, and then come back to me." And he, of course, that would eliminate quite a few people, which is most of them. And so he had very few students. He didn't develop a cult following like Prabhupada, who would accept any hippie off the street that was willing to believe him and go out and distribute his books. You know, he came here as a book distributor. He wanted to sell his books in the US and in England. So we talked about that a lot, you know, that kind of pretendian of Hindus. But I really want to get into this thing a little bit more about this urge for people to want to be indigenous, because I had it too as a kid. You know, I can remember at around 8 years old at the local creek, the Manitani Creek here. Manitani is a Delaware or Lenni Lenape word for where we go to drink. Mm. It's the name of the creek where I grew up, and it's about 50 yards from me right now. And in the Manitani Creek, I was looking for stuff like salamanders or whatever, and I picked up a bunch of stones, and in my palm of my hand was a white arrow. And it was like magic. I mean, it was perfectly formed. It was about maybe an inch long. It wasn't very big, but I really treasured that until my mother threw it out with a bunch of other stones I had on my desk and I lost it. But I never forgot that magic feeling, you know, because even as a kid, watching Chief Halftown, the Native American, he was really a full-blood Native American on this TV show in the 50s, introduced a variety show for children. You know, I was a watcher of Chief Halftown, and you kind of get this feeling of identification with Native American culture, and you want to be part of that mystique, you know. So, you know, I dressed like a Native American sometimes with a headband, and then when I became a hippie back in the late 60s, long hair, guess what? I had a headband, you know, just like a lot of hippies were adopting Native American stuff. They wanted to do sweat baths, and they wanted to, you know, do what they called, I forget, it's kind of like walkabout for the Aboriginals, but yeah. There was these mystic quests. You would go out and fast.
Spirit quests.
Yeah, spirit quests. So, you know, so all of that was going on in the hippie generation, and I kind of got caught up in a little of that too, you know, wanting a piece of Native American mystique, you know, in my life. And then we started reading Carlos Castaneda, which increased the Native American mystique, the whole neo-shamanism, which was also a total fake.
You know, it was the Yaki way.
Yeah, the Yaki thing was a whole pretendian thing. Yeah. You know, but millions of people got caught up.
Yeah.
Many millions. Right. For decades. I even know people today that still think that Carlos Castaneda was writing about a real thing.
Yeah.
You know, real experiences with a shaman.
Whereas in fact he was in his apartment in Los Angeles making it all up.
Right. He was more influenced by theosophy and Western occulture than real Native American anything. You know, but he pulled it off. He even got, you know, a PhD in anthropology based on his first book, you know, from some university that didn't catch the pretendian thing, you know.
Yeah.
You know, so this is an interesting topic to me because it does fit into the whole cult conversation of people claiming to be gurus, you know, and Zen masters and whatever. You know, we have this problem. It's one of the problems of cults to begin with is the deception by the leader about who they are. You know,
and you touch on the other aspect of it, which is the followers. That, I can remember watching David Carradine in Kung Fu as a 17-year-old. And I mean, I was completely flooded with Japanese and Chinese culture as a teenager. I made copies of ukiyo-e prints devotedly. And, you know, became interested in the Lao Tzu and Zen Buddhism, ended up at 18 in a Buddhist monastery for a few days. And I really get that thought of assuming that other identity, becoming that romanticized identity, which of course, when you look at the real lives of people in India or, you know, Native Americans, it wasn't a bed of roses. It wasn't. Arthur Koestler, when he, you know, who disgraced himself at the end of his life, but we won't go into that. He was great mates with Aldous Huxley. And in the 50s, to his dismay, you know, he'd seen Huxley, in fact, through the late 40s, writing The Perennial Philosophy and the wonderful novel Time Must Have a Stop. And he was sort of, what, you're being taken in, you're being conned. So Koestler went to Japan and to India to see what happened there and wrote an excellent book called The Lotus and the Robot, where he explains, for example, that in India, 98% of all the charities are run by Christian groups because in Hinduism, you have karma vipaka. You know, it's your fault what happens to you. So the idea of charity is not a fundamental aspect of that culture. And then, of course, going to Japan, you find that Zen masters were teaching, I think from the Meiji Restoration, what's 1868, I think, right through the Second World War, all of the soldiers were doing mindfulness meditation, which did not. John Kabat-Zinn is not correct. Daniel Goleman is not correct. It does not lead to compassion. It led to the nastiest civilian massacre of all time at Nanjing, which was, you know, the general who led it was congratulated by his Zen master. So, you know, these other cultures.
Yeah, in a similar vein, you know, Prabhupada, who brought the Krishnas to, or ISKCON to the U.S., he practically dismissed Hitler and the Holocaust in a lot of his sayings. He's known for that, you know, because it was, you know, he was a great man and the Jews maybe deserved it because of karma. You know, that kind of talk comes out of this. Interesting that the early theosophists, up until the 20s at least, were pretty much the same. When they adopted Buddhism, Hinduism into their ascended master culture, they weren't prone to give to charities because, again, they adopted this idea as the person's karma. You know, we shouldn't interfere with their karma by giving them millions of dollars in order to raise their village up. That changed later, of course, but the early theosophists were very much not charitable, except for maybe one that I can think of in the United States that, and she was considered anathema among other theosophists. But I ran into this whole thing about pretendians also when we did I worked with a TV crew, KOA TV in Albuquerque, New Mexico, in the late 1980s. And the reporter was Conroy Chino, C-H-I-N-O. He was a full-blooded Acoma Indian. Acoma is a sky city, Pueblo, outside of, and Conroy, you know, was educated in college and he became a newscaster, quite a good one in the area there. And so he got interested in looking into the New Age movement. And on all of that, and we worked on a series together, which was quite good, you know, exposing New Age stuff. And you know, I got to talking to him, and I said, you know, well, how do you feel about all these hippies trying to come to your? Because I knew they came and wanted to become part of the Sky City, the Acoma tribe, and whatever, and participate in rituals. He said, yeah, they just keep coming, you know, and our people just laugh at these people. What's wrong with you? You have your own culture, you know. We have the same. We don't have any more spirituality than you do in Christianity or Judaism or whatever you come from. You know, why are you trying to borrow from us? And they would politely tell them to go away. Mm. You know, we don't want you thinking that you can become an Indian all of a sudden. You know, and this was going on in the 80s and in the 70s, he said. Mm. But you know, they understood kind of why, because people project all this, like you said, romanticism. On indigenous people, that they're somehow closer to God, closer to the earth, you know, closer to being real and authentic, closer to being pure-blooded. Yeah. Alice Kehoe, the anthropologist, calls this reverse racism, that white culture will want to take and contain indigenous culture and then define it, you know, as it doesn't define itself. You know, because you need a professor from a college to define what it really is, right? Oh, and she, and so there was this whole movement, you know, among people, you know, part of that reservation thing. Let's contain them and keep them pure, you know, after trying to rip them out of their culture and make them white, you know, by making them not speak their native language in these schools that they were set up and whatever. You know, suddenly this whole movement came. So let's try to keep the races pure. You know, and Native Americans already been ruined. Most of them died off from whatever. And now they're struggling to modernize and still sustain their culture, their language, which is being lost because of the internet, basically. And you know, Native American youth don't speak their language very much. No. You know, so there's that problem. But the other thing that comes to mind is in Hawaii, the island of Niiau, where they wanted to contain pure Hawaiian culture. No one, it was a forbidden island. No one was allowed to go to it. It was owned by this family called the Robinsons. And so in a sense, they tried to preserve, again, white interference, trying to preserve the pure native culture and contain them on an island. So people couldn't leave the island for very long, or else they weren't allowed back. And no one was allowed to visit the island, you know. So it's almost like creating a kind of a fantasy land, a Jurassic Park of Hawaiians.
Epcot.
Yeah. Yeah. And trying to contain or preserve like a zoo thing. Mm. You know, let's preserve the last tigers. We don't want them to die. And so they do all these things like freeze embryos and, you know. Mm. All I'm saying is that all of this mulch of cultures and cults has created quite a mess, and I don't think we're going to get to untangle it. You know, I mean, Native Americans are dealing with very real modern problems today, and they don't need white people telling them how to be Indian, and they certainly don't need, you know, people taking advantage of the culture in order to enhance their own narcissistic drives, like Buffy St. Marie has done, you know. So, It's fascinating stuff. Yeah.
Isn't
Any
it?
more comments?
Yeah, I mean, it stirs so much comment. I have a sympathy for any group of people that wish to be independent from the culture around them. So when Catalonia declared its independence from Spain a few years ago, I was sort of, you know, I think they should have the right to a referendum to determine if they want to be part of the Federation of States, which we call Spain, which was most certainly a federation until 1492, or a group of separate states. If we look at the movements of nationalism, I don't understand why the Basque people in France and Spain, because they've been separate for thousands of years, they're really old people. Why can't they have independent government? Why do we have to force this together? And then as we look throughout the map of Europe, of course, there's very little that has remained consistent. The nations, you know, when Czechoslovakia became independent of the Warsaw Pact, it then split into two countries. But of course,
they were linguistic groups.
Exactly. And you have the same thing that's driven, you know, the Slavic nationalism that we're still seeing in Russia, which people...
Right. And also in Asia Minor, you have the Kurds.
Yeah.
Which are mixed up in two different nations, more three maybe.
Yeah, yeah. And generally oppressed within those nations.
Yes.
And to me, it seems that you should be able to separate off. Then you get the opposite drive, the kind of Garibaldi drive in Italy, and which is glossed over by many historians. And you realize that many of the people in the states of Italy did not want to be part of a superculture. You know, the Sicilians, for example.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The great novel The Leopard is about that period in time, and wonderful movie with Burt Lancaster in. But so many of these cultures, and then you get this assertion of some kind of purity when you look at the development of Nazi Germany and see that, you know, it starts, let's date it back to what, 1864, when Denmark decides it's going to have Schleswig-Holstein back, which is a stupid idea. And the Prussians completely trounce them. And then the Prussians take on the Austrians and they basically create an empire. And we talk about this country, Germany, but it only came into being in the 1870s. Very modern idea. And then you get all of the nationalism, all of the music, you know, Dvorak for the Czechs, Sibelius for the Finns, all of those great Russian composers. And this idea of a kind of national heritage, which is something that's fixed in a collective imaginary unconscious, this idea that we've always been this. Now, even looking at Christianity is a really good example, that century by century, it would be pretty hard for Christians of the first century to recognize anything in a Christian church now, including...
But again, think back a minute.
You know,
when you say Christians of the first century, you're talking about a movement of Jesus people that was thousands of different groups that didn't all agree. You know, there were...
And it's homogenized in 325 at the Council of Nicaea, where the Emperor Constantine tells them, you've got to sort out what you agree on, or I'm going to kill you, you know?
Yeah, you have... I mean, you already have it in St. Paul's letters, the earliest indications of this. There were factions already formed that he was arguing, you know, what's the real Jesus? You know, what's his real message? Hmm? It was diverging, and then he was arguing with Peter, who was... with the real Jesus, and he wasn't, you know, he was persecuting all those people. We don't even know if he ever met Jesus in the flesh.
Well, we believe that Paul. He didn't. That's what's taught, isn't it?
Paul, we believe he didn't.
He had the vision on the road to Damascus, asking why he was persecuting
him. His was more of a charismatic or, you know, post-Pentecostal connection to the whole movement. But anyway, yeah, the whole movement was disparate from the beginning. It wasn't kept together until there was a text called the Gospel, which doesn't jive all the way either. The Gospel of John is very different from the Synoptic Gospels, and then there's the Acts. Anyway, you know, we are towers of Babel as humans. And so I can understand why there's such an urge for people to be connected to a whole, to a one thing, to a cult leader. You know, that can pull in saying, you know, I'm connected to the source of information. You know, Werner Erhard was called Source.
And L. Ron Hubbard, of course, the source.
Source, you know, and you know, Elizabeth Prophet, you know, my old cult leader, she was the mother of the universe, connected to the Great White Brotherhood of the entire universe. You know, it wasn't just here in our solar system. It was everywhere. And
the whole universe.
And to have that sense of wholeness, of connection, of being one with the origin of being itself is such a pull on us. But this is what I'd like to submit, is that you cannot not be one with the origin of being. There's nothing you have to do except breathe. And you are now connected to the oneness and the origin of being. You don't have to read anything. You don't have to believe anything. You just have to breathe and go about your life. And you are all totally connected to all this. You don't need anybody telling you this or saying that the best path to it is to become a Native American something or other, or a Scientology something or other, or a ISKCON Krishna something or other, to be connected to the God, meaning Krishna. You know, I've been tossing this out around a lot lately because of a client I had that asked me about this, because he was involved in Protestant Christianity, the Methodist, and then became a Catholic for 20 years, and now doesn't like the trap he's in as a Catholic. He's beginning to realize that it's a closed kind of a system in his mind that fits Hassan's bite model. And this is bothering, you know, quite a bit. So I'm trying to break it down for him and say, listen, you don't have to be a Christian or the Christian, you know, the specific Jehovah Witness Christian or the United Church of Christ Christian or the Roman Catholic Christian, or a liberal person that says, you know, I'm a Christian, so that you're separate from Buddhists. You can just be Christian, meaning you don't have to say anything. You can just do good things for people. You can follow what the gospel says, you know, feed the hungry, visit the sick, visit the imprisoned, you know, do random acts of kindness. You are Christian at that point, much like the parable of the Samaritan. He wasn't part of the people. You know, he wasn't a legitimate Jew or whatever. He was a Samaritan. He was an outsider. He did a kind act, and according to Jesus, that was Christian. He was in the kingdom of heaven for eternity at that moment. You know, so this is what I was trying to bring across to this client. I think in the same way, you can say there is God. You don't have to say there is the God or there is a God according to a definition. You don't have to define anything. You can even say there is being, you know, there is existence, and leave it at that. And you're fine. You're into, you don't have to be atheist in that sense. You can be, you know, in fact, I think an atheist can say there is being. They agree with that, which is all I think the gospel and any of these great traditions are saying. There is being. Let's do something about it. We're part of this. You know, we're on the human scale. Let's try to behave well, and these are our rules and regulations, and shake hands and get along with each other, and make sure that the old people are fine and that the young people grow. And, you know, it's not that hard to think it, but it's really hard to do that. You know, we tend to form factions very quickly because of our insecurity, our inability to trust the other. And then, of course, we have cult leaders like and celebrities that want to have their identity formed a specific way and have people believe in that identity, draw them away from more universal acceptance of self, you know, as being, and become more indigenized or more involved in some kind of a silo experience, and feeling more comfortable in a cocoon, more protected from the outside, you know, in terms of thoughts, ideas, or people, or whatever. I don't know, I'm rambling here, but all of this Pretendian thing expanded into a whole bigger discussion to me about what all that means.
Yeah, and I think it's extremely interesting, you know, the extent to which we are, all of us, pretending rather than simply breathing.
Like I'm speaking a particular language here, which separates me from all other languages, right?
Yeah.
And if I speak Hungarian, like, hogy vagy, Jan, like, how are you, John? Now I'm Hungarian. Now you wouldn't understand me. I'm separate. I would be totally separate from you. We wouldn't be able to communicate.
Yeah. We need Douglas Adams' Babelfish to stick in our ears so we'll be able to understand each other. Yeah.
And we do have that with Google Translator.
Well, a version of it.
but we're getting close, you know, we're getting close.
Yeah, it's true. And I think it is that we take on the, you know, the clothing that identifies us in a certain way. And we look back at being hippies and, you know, your headband, and I had shoulder length hair, believe it or not, for 10 years and wore yellow loon trousers and, you know, kind of thing. Yeah, absolutely. Not for the whole 10 years. I did wash them occasionally. But I can really, you know, I really get that, because that was something that started for me when I was probably about 13. And I started listening to music and going, you know, I don't listen to pop music anymore. I listen to blues and I listen to proper rock music. You know, I listen to Led Zeppelin and Jimi Hendrix. And there is a kind of elitism that is certainly part of any cult group. The idea that we are the people that have the knowledge, or more precisely, the guy that tells us what to do has the knowledge. We're pretty sure of that because he says he does. And he's got a nice mustache, you know, so he probably does. That this sense of, and that's part of the family thing, isn't it? I mean, a friend Yuval Law would point to the forms of attachment that we have, that we adopt a parent, that's the cult leader. We adopt siblings, they're the other cult members. And as he puts it, we adopt the doctrine, and that's the baby. Don't criticize the baby, whatever you do.
Okay.
And we make ourselves different from others in the quest to make ourselves the same, to make ourselves part of the great all, or whatever it is. And as you say, that as we have become old and weathered with time, I have the sense for you that it's the same as for me. I couldn't care less. You know, the whole thing about an afterlife or heaven or reincarnation, it doesn't mean anything. And it used to be very important to me. But now, the eternal now, you know, this is it. What I'm doing here is it. And I'm very, very lucky because, you know, I'm not suffering from any drastic illness. I have enough to eat. You know, I have the luxury of friends and family.
That the crew where I was being filmed for this documentary asked me that question at the end. You know, what do you think God is? What do you think happens after you die? And all of that. And you know, so I kind of blurted out that, you know, I grew up Catholic, and I remember going on Ash Wednesday, walking up to get my ashes on my forehead, and the priest saying, "From dust you came, to dust you shall return."
There you go.
And I think if you stop there, that's reality. And if you want to look at what we know of science, you could say, "From stardust we came, and to stardust we shall return." As far as what we know, that's it.
Billion-year-old.
That's what I told them on this show, because that's what I came out with. You know, as far as what we want and what we imagine, we come up with all kinds of concoctions and aesthetic values and ways of harnessing nature, with calling the thunder a god and all of this before we could really harness it. You know, so the strangeness around us, the mystery, through our language, we became bewitched by our own words. Mm-hmm. You know, we would say, "Well, that's the thunder god," and someone would say, "What do you mean?" And we'd say, "Well, it's speaking to us.
It's banging on an anvil.
Kind of like
in
us.
The sky.
You know, it can talk." And then that guy listening draws a picture of a thunder god and said, "You think he might look like this? Hey, that's great. Let's put that on our temple." You know.
And sooner or later, you've got the Marvel comics and Thor. Yeah. Instead
right,
of
so we are consummate artists. You know, we are continually creating these everything from languages to forms to shelters to whatever. And you know, it's a mix of science and art. It's a mix of practicality and entertainment. You know, a big part of us needs entertainment in order to be enriched. You know, we tell stories. We not only want to know what the scientists learned, we want to know about the scientist's life and the funny things he did. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's this, to make us complete, we can get tangled up in our own narratives. And if those narratives are too constrictive, they can become cult-like.
I think so. And then the narrative aspect of that, Claude Daniel Dennett talked about the self being the center of narrative gravity. Now, I'm not a tremendous fan of Dennett's generally, but that phrase.
I like that, though. I like the idea.
Beautiful. You know, as David Copperfield by Dickens starts something like, it remains to be seen if I shall be the hero of my own life. And you are. And so much of it is this drive to be individual, to be perpetual, to live forever, light up the sky with your name and all of that stuff. And actually to rejoin the whole, the communion, you know, oneness with God, the Buddha mind, Nirvana, whatever you want to call it. And so you've got this dynamic, and there is a rather simple solution, which is, if you something like the Buddhist Anatta, that the self is an illusion, the self is something that's generated by a person, and the self rises and falls. And this desperate urge to be eternal, well, we are. It's already happened. You know, here we are in time. And it all sounds so complicated and difficult, but it's actually very simple. That I'm not a permanent being. I just don't have that sense anymore. And I didn't like that, being a Buddhist, the idea of, you know, the fear of the eternal return, as Buddhists put it, that you're on the wheel of suffering, you just keep going around. And in the end, I decided I didn't want to get off the wheel of suffering, that it didn't really matter, what is it, as John Popper in Blues Traveler said, we all get a chance and then we're forgiven. And that's now what I believe, that we live this
life. I think
the
same way. I think it's the same thing, that it appears to me that after dust, we become dust again, that whatever it is that's doing all this, because something is doing all this, I don't know what it is, but it's got to be forgiving. And I think that's the insight of Christianity that's the best thing it's given the world, is that this being couldn't exist unless it continually forgave its own mistakes somehow.
Yeah,
it has to self-purify. It has to self-purify. Mm. Otherwise, it would disappear in its own diseases.
Yeah.
You know, so the whole universe, you know, you have galaxies colliding, worlds upon worlds are now appearing and disappearing. This is what I told this crew. You know, they asked me, does God make mistakes? I said, well, he kind of has galaxies will collide. Do you call that a mistake? Mm. Or do you call that a creative act? Which way are you going to flip it? You know, because in a sense, there's a lot of self-creation going on when galaxies, which we can't even conceive of, how many life forms are now being eliminated, and then through aeons and billions of years being recreated in different forms. Mm. You know, what is that? You know, I can sort of imagine it, but I can't wrap my head around it beyond my own experience. You know, watching, you know, for instance, somebody plowing a forest down and then allowing it to go fallow, and then the forest sort of comes back different. You know, it'll take maybe 40, 50 years, but you see a forest growing back. That's maybe what happens when galaxies destroy most of one another and stars are reborn, new black holes form, and all these gases emanate and explode all over the place. Gravity in the black holes, or the what they call the web of the universe, begin to reshape these things, and new stuff happens. I don't know. I can't get around that. I mean, to me, that's eternity. It's maybe in flux. Maybe the yin yang idea is the best idea that we can describe to make it simple, you know, to put it on a little metal on your neck or whatever. But
the Dai Chi, yeah.
But all of this stuff, the Dai Chi, yeah, all of this stuff appeals to people for a reason. And I think that getting overly excited about it can get you in trouble, you know. And I think to some extent, the Zen people maybe are correct to just breathe and let it go, you know. But don't make a big deal out of, you know, that this is the way to do it. You have to make a Zen garden. You have to have a house. You have to have a certain kind of mat. You have to, you know, breathe a certain way. You have to study with a certain master because he's the best. I mean, after a while, it can make you crazy.
And if you pronounce the Sanskrit wrong, you have to go back to the beginning.
The beginning, right.
Which is quite something. Wrong. Yeah.
Well, anyway, I think we've covered a lot.
I think we've probably covered enough.
We've covered enough.
It's always a pleasure, Joe.
Well, it was fun.
We'll meet again in a month or two. Yep.
Well, we'll do that. Thank you, John. Enjoy
Thank
your
you.
Day. And I hope you feel better.
I will.
Okay. Take care, man.
Hi, John here. Thanks for watching. We'd appreciate it very much if you would click like, as well as subscribe, and click the bell for notifications. Every dollar helps, and we welcome new patrons on Patreon, or you can make a one-off payment with any currency through PayPal. Thanks so much.
Frogs have rights too.